We are back on the Andy Finn Show, and let's talk a little bit about the war on science. So, Michael Gerson, a relatively well-known Republican and not a complete lunatic, wrote an interesting editorial last week in the Washington Post. Interesting because I disagree with just about everything he said. But he talked about a phony war on science. Right? And his basic premise was that this is nonsense that Republicans are conducting a war on science. All right? Well, if you've been following the list of things, there are dozens and dozens of examples of the war on science. And it isn't just global warming and the failure to come to grips with it. We've gone 8 years without taking action. It isn't just ignoring recommendations of science from NIH and NIMH and a variety of other things. It isn't just squelching documents that should have been released, but were produced by scientists but held up by bureaucrats appointed by George W. Bush. It's a whole range of things. And basically, let me just give you an example of how Gerson starts out. There are a few things in American politics more irrationally ideological, more fanatically faith-based than the accusation that Republicans are conducting a, quote, war on science. Well, what's interesting right there is the phrases he uses, irrationally ideological, fanatically faith-based. You know, this is the article that, I mean, the argument that Ann Coulter made in her last book, in which she basically spent several chapters making the case that science is actually an exercise in faith and that they take things on faith as opposed to testing them, which of course is an absurd proposition. And she went back to try and disprove evolution by going back to the mistakes that have been made in the history of the theory of evolution back, you know, to the 1920s and the Piltdown man and evidence that ended up being phony, and as though that's an argument against our current understanding of evolution. But that's Coulter. I expect better things from Gerson. He prints an article. I mean, his editorial's printed twice a week in the Washington Post, and I'm spending my time reading it. I expect something a little better. So he goes on to make the case that there are exceptions, okay, to this. And what he means is he basically lists three examples of good work that's been done that the Bush administration has let go forward. All right? So whether it's the large-scale AIDS treatments in Africa, the human genome system, or reforms in the National Institute of Health that were widely praised for their efficiency, that's his evidence that there's no war on science. It isn't, when people use the expression war on science, it isn't that they're trying to shut down everything that has to do with science. It's a very selective kind of a thing, right? So that's not quite evidence that there's no war on science. Let's see. Gerson goes on. For the most part, these accusations are a political ploy, actually an attempt to shut down political debate. And any practical concern about the content of government sex education currently is labeled anti-science. And see, let me go on. Any ethical question about the destruction of human embryos to harvest their cells is dismissed as theological and thus illegitimate. Well, let me take those points one at a time. The first thing about sex education, the Bush administration has been pushing this abstinence-only policy. So the argument is, and Laura Bush has made it, and the administration has made it, is that abstinence-only should be taught in schools. Okay? Now, it turns out that abstinence-only, kids will not listen. The majority of kids will not listen to abstinence messages. They are going to have sex. So the question is, are we going to teach them about sexually transmitted diseases and the risks of pregnancy so that they can avoid both? That's in the U.S. The other issue is, internationally, are we going to take our agenda of abstinence and restrict what we're able to tell third world populations? And in fact, that's what we've done. The Bush administration has put strings on the money so that it cannot go to provide anything from, you know, condoms to education that disagrees with the ideology of the administration. That is anti-science in a couple of ways. One is that the evidence has come in over the last few years that abstinence-only education is not leading to fewer pregnancies or fewer sexually transmitted diseases. Okay? The statistics show that it simply doesn't work. It's not an improvement. In fact, it's worse in some populations. That's where the science comes in, Mr. Gearson, right? It's not about the ideology. The first concern was practical. It didn't seem to make sense that it would work simply because teenagers' hormones are raging, and so telling them not to have raging hormones doesn't work. But secondly, the evidence is now in that it doesn't work. The second issue here about the destruction of human embryos to harvest eggs, keep in mind that we've got approximately 400,000 human embryos frozen in fertility clinics that are never going to be used. So they may not get destroyed this week, next year, but eventually they're going to be destroyed. Now, we can say we shouldn't have that, right? But those are the embryos that people want to use in stem cell research. And the Bush administration has forbidden it, even though they avoid the inconvenience of what's going to happen to those embryos. Let's move on. Let's see. Mrs. Michael Gearson again. Liberal views are, quote, objective, while traditional moral convictions are, quote, biased. Public scrutiny of scientific practice is politicizing important decisions. Well, public scrutiny is one thing, but what does public scrutiny mean? If you listen to the level of the discussion, whether it's global warming or some other scientific issue, there's not, I mean, it's reduced to the things I talked about before. It comes up at the level of, you know, it's been kind of cold out, and yet they say there's global warming. Or I was listening to Laura Ingraham a few months ago, and she was talking about how rainy it is in Europe or wherever it was at the time. And she said, now, wouldn't you think if we're getting global warming, if it's getting hotter, then you wouldn't have as much rain? Because obviously you think of hot and dry going together. I mean, that is just absurd. But that's what passes for public scrutiny of scientific practices. Now, the way to do public scrutiny of scientific practices is to find other scientists who can compete at the same level and hold discussions in the literature and then have people evaluate it. The science has gotten so complex, lay people just can't really understand the debates. It would be like in the case of, let's take somebody's had a heart attack and they're trying to decide on treatments, right? Or cancer, trying to decide on what your options are. You ultimately let someone make their own decision if they want chemotherapy or not, if they want radiation or not. But you lay out for them what their options are. That is, well, if you have the chemo, you'll be in a certain amount of pain and nausea, and it'll add this much to your life. Or this is inoperable cancer, so you're better off just going home, taking the last few weeks you have. Whatever the doctor tells you, right? And then people make their individual decision and say, yes, I'd like the chemo. I want to stay alive as long as possible. I'll take the radiation, or whatever they decide. But that's making a decision once you've been informed of what the situation is. Questioning the literature and the science on global warming for lay people is the equivalent of questioning what your doctor says about the efficacy of chemo versus radiation versus doing nothing. And it would be like a lay person saying, well, I know that the three doctors I've talked to all say that, you know, I should go for the chemo and then the radiation and I can live up to 3 years. But, you know, I've got this other expert over here. Now, he hasn't published anything in this field. In fact, he's a holistic healer of some sort, hasn't been to medical school. But he thinks that if I just change my diet, I could live 10 years. So I think I'm going to go with his advice. Now, are you free to do that? Yeah, it's a great country. You're free to do that. But when there are decisions that affect the whole country, that affect me, you're not free to follow cockamamie advice. Let's continue with Michael Gearson's column on the phony war on science that he defends Republicans against from last Wednesday's Washington Post. Let's see. Let me go on. This is boring. That stuff is boring. Let's see what this says. In Science and the Left, his insightful article. Oops, who are we talking about here? I don't see the name. In Science and the Left, Yuval Levin's insightful article in the latest issue of New Atlantis, he argues that a belief in the power of science is central to the development of liberalism. Well, I think that that is true in general. It comes out of the Enlightenment and the idea that science had a better answer to most of the issues involving empirical evidence than did tradition and authority, mostly the church and the king. Okay, so the power of science is central to the development of liberalism based on the assertion that objective facts and rational planning can replace tradition and religious authority in the organization of society. Well, I don't know that it says it can replace tradition. I think they both have a place. Okay, Levin summarizes the liberal promise this way, quote, the past was rooted in error and prejudice, while the future would have at its disposal a new oracle of genuine truth. Well, I think science did at one time believe it was, quote, genuine truth. But, you know, most scientists have backed off that. That's where the third level of intellectual development has taken hold at the universities. That is, there's an understanding of relativism that knowledge itself is contextual. And that's thrown the universities into a tizzy at times. But people over the last 30, 40 years at university levels have come to grips with the idea that knowledge is relative. That would drive Gearson crazy, I'm sure. Let's let Gearson continue. Quote, but the oracle of science is silent on certain essential topics. Science, simply put, says Levin, cannot account for human equality and does not offer reasons to believe we are all equal. Science measures our material and animal qualities and it finds them to be patently unequal. Well, okay, I go along with that. And I certainly go along with the idea that science is silent on essential topics. Science has nothing to say about anything that's not empirical. Faith, things we can't see, or I shouldn't say can't see, can't empirically demonstrate, areas of morals. Okay. Without a firm, morally grounded belief in equality, liberalism has been led down some dark paths. The old progressive eugenics of the late 19th and early 20th centuries involve widespread sterilization of the mentally disabled. Okay, I see where he's going with this. Basically, he's saying that if you carry your belief in science too far, you make mistakes. That's true with any set of absolutes. If you put absolute faith in the king, absolute faith in the church, absolute faith in science, these are all man-made structures, and they're going to let you down. You need a mix of views and a mix of ideas to make a society work. And then he goes on to talk about Nazism and eugenics. Okay, so let's get to his point. But the point here is not to catch liberalism in an inconsistency. At its best, the liberal tradition has combined its belief in science with a firm commitment to the equal value of all, including the disabled and the imperfect. Good point. But science can easily become a power of some over the lives of others. And in their talk of a Republican war on science, liberals may be blinding themselves to a very different kind of modern war in which their own ideals are deeply implicated, a war on equality. You know, this is really such a weak argument. I thought it was a better argument the first time I read it, but it's not. Basically, he hasn't really shown, and I guess this was the point of me bringing it up, he hasn't really shown that there is no war on science. He's given three examples of how Republicans have allowed science to flourish in three specific areas during the Bush administration. But there are 100 examples. Get the book, The Republican War on Science, or just look it up on the web. There's all kinds of articles out there about the number of times that the Bush administration has ignored the evidence that scientists have brought forth and made political decisions simply because their ideology didn't allow them to go with the science. And I guess the last thing I'll say about this is this. One of the things that's always amazed me, I think I mentioned this last week, always amazed me about the United States as I looked, as I lived through the 60s and mostly the 70s, was that as we had better standards for clean air and clean water, and we started cleaning up pollution, and we passed laws to control the power of corporations in some of these areas and limit the damage they could do. I was always amazed because you usually assume that the powers that be, the corporate structures, the people that have the money, are going to influence Congress, get the laws passed they wanted. And yet, we managed to strike a balance between the power of organizations that wish to just, you know, make profit and don't have a particular responsibility to society, but just to their stockholders. We found a balance between that and the laws that governed them that cleaned up our water and cleaned up our air. And we now take that stuff for granted, and, you know, the Rush Limbaughs of the world can find fault with environmentalist wackos. But let's not forget that without the environmental movement, we wouldn't have had that progress. So the war on science is real as far as I'm concerned, and I cannot wait until the Bush administration is gone so that we're back to making reality-based decisions, decisions based on empirical evidence. And then if you have to compromise politically because you don't want to declare a wildlife area off limits because of one particular animal species that might go extinct, then you make that decision in the world, in the realm of politics. But let's not start by denying the science and saying that it's wrong, which is what we often get. In any case, we're going to take a short break here on the Andy Finn Show. And when we come back, we'll talk a little bit about politics and the current state of the race.
Hi, I'm Andy Finn, and I am begging you to listen to my show at www.andyfinn.us.
The Andy Finn Show, Uncommon Talk Radio.
We are back on the Andy Finn Show, and let's finish up this segment with a little bit about the election that is coming up. So, a couple of things are happening. More and more pressure is being put on Hillary Clinton to leave the race after Obama won last week in North Carolina. He won big in double digits, and she only won by 2 percentage points in Indiana. So it wasn't the game changer she had hoped for. And more superdelegates went to him. The problem is that they're running out of runway. They're running out of road. And it's pretty clear the numbers now favor him. So the question is, what's she going to do? That's what people keep talking about. I'm not too worried about it in this regard. There's several good things happening on the Democratic side. It is true McCain is getting a free ride. It is true that Clinton and Obama have been beating each other up. But two aspects of this that are worth remembering for Democrats. One is Obama's being toughened by this. Now, Hillary is probably going to lay off and not go after him as hard as she has been, primarily because if it's not winnable at this point, there's no point in her continuing to beat him up hard and going after him with comments like she made last Tuesday about how white voters, essentially hardworking white people, he can't attract them. I think she's going to stop that wetwick, but we'll see. But also, it is toughening him up. And so whatever the 527s throw at him this summer, and I don't think it'll be McCain primarily. I mean, McCain has come out and said he's not ready, he's naive, he doesn't understand the Middle East, he doesn't understand world events. You know, that's how I feel about John McCain, frankly, because McCain's not realistic about a bunch of things. But that's a legitimate debate to have. But the 527s are going to come out and claim everything from he's a Muslim to he's not a good enough Christian to he believes what Reverend Wright believes, or he believes what Bill Ayers believes, or whatever else they come up with. You know, maybe he had a white baby. Who knows what they're going to come up with that they're going to blame on him. But he's been toughened up by this campaign. And so that's going to help him longer term. The second thing that's happened is because of the high interest in the Democratic primaries, huge numbers of people have come out. In one recent primary, I think it was North Carolina, more people voted in the Democratic primary than voted for John Kerry in the actual election. Now, usually your primary brings out about a quarter of the voters that you get in a general election. So what's happening is Democratic voters are getting energized. They're registering if they weren't already registered. If they were registered, they're getting back to the polls to vote, which means it's a dry run for November. They know where their polling place is. If they made a mistake and they went to the wrong school in town because it used to be there, they're like, oh, okay, so my polling place is now over at this school or this library or this government building. So it's a dry run, and come November, there'll be fewer surprises for Democratic voters. So the turnout should be pretty high. And in that regard, I think the Democrats are helped by this whole process. We shall see. Anyway, tomorrow we now have the Nebraska primary, which is for the Republicans have the Nebraska primary, and the Democrats have the West Virginia primary tomorrow. Another week is Hawaii. I guess it's only the Republicans. And then May 20th is Kentucky and Oregon. And then we're almost done. We're early June, we're all done. So I think Hillary will stay in the race until the end. And I don't think that that'll be a too big a problem. People are, you know, trying to figure out how to get her out, but I'm not too worried about it. I think it'll take care of itself longer term. And let's see. The other thing that's was interesting this week was that it came out that John McCain supposedly refused to vote for George W. Bush in 2000. Now, he has since denied the story, but it was printed on Arianna Huffington's blog, and some news outlet confirmed it. So there was a party at somebody's house. Was it Barbara Streisand? That would seem to be the typical liberal kind of a thing. But, I'm trying to think. It doesn't matter whose party, but it was a Hollywood party. And two of the members of the West Wing cast, Bradley Whitford and Richard Schiff, were at this party. And they said that, yes, Senator McCain said exactly that. He talked at length about his reservations about Bush becoming president, right? And that neither he nor his wife voted for George W. Bush, okay? Now, I think that makes perfect sense that he wouldn't after the way Bush savaged him in South Carolina, claiming he had an illegitimate black baby when, in fact, he had adopted, and claiming that he probably wasn't fit to be president because he was, you know, too high strung from the time he spent in the Hanoi Hilton, all that crap that Bush and Rove pulled on him. I could see why he wouldn't vote for Bush. And I guess I could see why he might deny what he said now, except you really should always tell the truth. So that's just kind of a small issue. The other thing, I don't have to go into all these, quote, little scandals that are coming up, but one of the interesting things, the Washington Post did a whole long article the end of last week on a land swap that John McCain sponsored that basically helped former staffers of his who are lobbyists now. They lobbied him, and it was a windfall for the people who wanted this land deal. They basically swapped ranch land out in the middle of nowhere for land near a developed area that could be turned into houses right away and somebody could make millions of dollars. So there's a detailed article. I'm not going to go into the details of it at this point. But there was an interesting exchange on The Daily Show that I thought was funny last week, and I didn't think that Jon Stewart got enough credit for this. So McCain has surprised me a little bit because, you know, he's always wanted to be the Straight Talk Express stuff. And some of what he does bugs me. Like, he brought up that Hamas has come out and endorsed Obama. Now, there's a McCain campaign letter, a fundraising letter, in which they point out that Hamas has endorsed Obama. And when asked about it, McCain defended it and said that, you know, hey, that's what their spokesperson said. And Jon Stewart said, and so you take Hamas at their word, which I thought was hilarious. In other words, whatever they say, you assume they're telling the truth. Of course he doesn't. Of course he doesn't. And you take Hamas at their word. I love it. Well, that's going to do it for another edition of the Andy Finn Show here on WEBR Radio. I've enjoyed it. I hope you've enjoyed it. I'll be back next Monday night, and we'll pick up on a whole variety of things, from frick to frack, from apples to oranges, from soup to nuts, from who knows what to who knows where. In any case, until then, you can listen to previous shows or my blog at andyfinn.us. That's andyfinn.us. And until then, remember, do it. Don't doubt it.